Tracy Beatty is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Beatty to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will air live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for one-third of all U.S. executions in the modern era. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Pat McCann, an appellate specialist, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Linda Snyder, and special guest Clinton Young, out on bail from Texas death row. We'll also be airing a live interview, recorded from death row, of Tracy Beatty. We will air that live. We'll air that in full and unedited. The execution watch for Tracy Beatty begins.
Hello, and welcome to our listeners around the world on this Wednesday, November 9th edition of Execution Watch. We hold this show whenever the state of Texas execute a prisoner. I'm Marlo Blue. If you're tuning in for What's Your Story with Hank Rubicek, Hank and the gang will be back in 2 weeks. Tonight we bring you live news coverage as the state of Texas plans to execute 61-year-old Tracy Beatty, condemned in the 2003 murder of his mother, Carolyn Click. This is the fourth execution carried out by the state of Texas into 2022. Execution Watch and Houston Media Source TV conducted an interview with Mr. Beatty to be aired on this program in the second half of the show, so please stay tuned for that. Let's first go to our reporter outside of the death house in Huntsville, Linda Snyder. Linda, hello. Thank you for joining us.
Hello. They just crossed the line, all the family.
Would you please explain to our listeners who may not understand what that means, what exactly that means? Why is that the signal?
Well, once they cross the parking lot and go into the death house, that means the execution is going forward.
Tell us a little bit about Tracy.
I didn't really know Tracy. I never got to sit down and talk to him, so I can't really tell you a lot about him.
Do we know who's going to be witnessing for Tracy?
His wife.
Thank you so much.
He just got married 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Linda, it sounds like there are quite a few people out there with you. Can you describe the scene a little bit for us?
Yes, there's a lot of people out there. There's a lot of college students out there, too. And it's really more of a crowd tonight than it has been in the past.
We can hear so many of the different groups, and of course we can hear Gloria Rubick out there with her microphone.
Yes.
Linda, thank you so much for doing this for us. Please let us know when you hear something else coming out.
When they come out, yes.
Thank you, Linda. Joining us now to put this case into perspective is our panel of experts. We're going to start off first with our chief legal analyst, Larry B. Douglas, our legal analyst, Mike Gillespie, and our special guest, Clinton Young, who is a former death row inmate. Larry, lead us off. Tell us what happened in this case.
Okay, Marlo. Tracy Beatty grew up in a little town called White House. That's up in Smith County near Tyler.
Okay.
Fairly small town. Something of a maybe troubled youth, born in the early 80s, or early 60s, I'm sorry, dropped out of high school right after the 10th grade and started to get in trouble as a young 20-plus-year-old man. His first major case was injury to a child that he applied an live electrical wire, according to the report, to his 18-month-old niece. Pulled her hair, burned her with a cigarette, smashed her in the face. for that he was sentenced. He had a trial, and for that he was sentenced to 4 years. That was in the early 80s. Then, about 1988, he got in trouble again on an auto theft case for which he got 15 years. That's in 1988. Then in 1990, while in prison, he got 3 more years tacked onto that for a charge of assaulting a prison official. He paroled out in the early 2000s, but then went back to prison on a parole violation for having assaulted his mother. Then in 03, he gets out again in October 03, and his mother, Carolyn Click, had him come to live with her. Now, they had a tumultuous relationship, but she told her neighbor that she wanted to try to mend things with him. So this was in October of 03, and the neighbors say that they, Beatty and his mother, fought almost every day. The responsibility, I mean, she didn't get along with him, he didn't get along with her. One of the neighbors actually started having Beatty come over to her house and just do odd chores, just to let him get a little bit of money because he wasn't working at the time. So this neighbor, Leanne Wilkerson, actually had him house sit for her. Not that she was going out of town, but not that she needed anybody to house sit for her. She said, "I really just had him come over and house sit for me when I was out, to give him a place to go when his mother puts him out, because she put him out from time to time, and then she let him come back in." She had another neighbor her next door neighbor, they talked quite a bit. That was Betty McCarty. These were witnesses at trial.
And that became really a major part of the trial, which we'll go into in a bit, yes?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm just laying this out for what happened at trial. So these are trial witnesses. He was convicted of capital murder, which it was a murder, but the special circumstance that the state used in this case was that they alleged that he committed the act of burglary. Okay, so it was burglary of the house that he lived in, but they tied that to the fact that his mother told the neighbor on the day that she was apparently murdered, that is, so he moved in with her in October of 2003. The murder occurred November 25th, 2 days before Thanksgiving in 03. The neighbor says that the mother told her that, this is the neighbor, Betty McCarty, says that the mother came over really, really frantic, saying, I asked him to leave. That was her testimony. Initially that she told Betty, she asked Betty to leave, and then later she told him to leave. This is around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And that's the last time she saw the mother alive.
Let me ask you a question right now. What is the difference between murder and capital murder in the state of Texas?
Okay, well, capital murder is clearly murder. And there have to be aggravating circumstances, such that the murder of a child, multiple people being murdered at the same time, or the murder in the commission of another felony. So in this case, they used murder of a police officer. In this case, they used that underlying felony. The felony was burglary or a robbery. Now, the way they tried to make that was the claim that Ms. Glick had, the mother had told Beatty to leave, that she put him out. So they claimed that he broke into the house. And the burglary requires that it's the breaking and entering of a habitation without the consent of the owner, with the intent to commit a robbery or some other felony. So their claim was he broke into her house without her consent, and there's no showing of whether she granted or denied consent to him, other than the neighbor saying she told him to leave. She told him to leave several times before and she'd always take him back. So whether she granted that consent or withdrew that consent at any time, it's just not seen. But what he supposedly did was they claimed that he murdered her, and he actually confessed later on that he did commit the murder. The murder occurs at some point during that day. We're not sure exactly when, but after the murder, what he does is he goes to one of his cousin's houses. The cousin is about 45 minutes away. He goes to the cousin's house. The cousin sees him driving the mother's car, and she knows that there's something wrong because the mother never lets him drive the car, never lets anybody drive the car. And he tells her, well, she's out of town for a few days, and she's going to be back later on. So then he leaves there and goes over to another neighbor's house and has spaghetti and brings her a turkey, saying, we were going to cook this turkey, but mom's out of town. Now she went out of town with a friend of hers, so we don't need it. He gives her the turkey. And then he leaves. Okay, now there's some evidence that after he leaves that he takes the mother's car and that he goes on a drug binge. And he's also telling people that he killed his mother. He told a lot of people that he killed his mother. When the police finally catch up with him, this is closer to Christmas time now, and they talk to him about what happened, and he told them several different stories, as he told several other people a lot of different stories, that she went out of town, that she had a boyfriend named Junior, and that Junior killed her. And Beatty said, then I killed Junior, and I put his body in the lake. And then he says, well, actually, I killed my mom, and I buried her body in the backyard. He kept going back to burying the body in the backyard. And that's where she was found, in a shallow grave in the backyard. The evidence comes from him, from his confessions also, that he left her body in the bathtub for a couple of days, but he says that what happened was, and one of the last descriptions he gives is that, well, I got home after I had the spaghetti dinner, I was drunk, she attacked me, I just overreacted, I choked her, and I didn't even know she died until the next morning I saw her body on the floor. But those are some of the various stories that he told regarding how the whole incident occurred. And he goes to trial, and he's found guilty of capital murder. And that's why we're here.
Joining us now at the table is Patrick McCann, criminal defense attorney and one of our guests tonight. Patrick, what about the appeals and his past days? Can you tell us anything? Or
most of them had to do with his mental status, whether ongoing at the time of the crime or in the ensuing years. He appears to be, at least from the pleading, someone who may suffer from what's called a dual diagnosis, someone who may have both mental illness and a possible intellectual disability impairment. They've not been able to establish the ID, and that was the subject of one of the last stays. Part of the complaint was that they weren't allowed to have a hands-free exam for his neurological impairments, which relate to the ID. That is unfortunately a common situation, that the prison will not allow an inmate to have free use of his hands. Those are critical for some of the tests that a neurologist or a neuropsychologist will impose on someone to see if they have impairment. It involves, for instance, spatial manipulation and some other items.
I'm sorry, are you saying he was handcuffed during his evaluations?
Oh, yeah, that's very common.
And shackled?
Normally, yeah. When folks from death row are brought to you, unless they're in a confined space, and if you've ever been to death row, they have metal cages on the other side. When they come in to those, They turn around, the guard then can uncuff them, and they can at least use their hands for some visits. But if you are, for instance, at this table distance between you and I, they will normally be shackled for any kind of medical exam.
Let me take a moment here, and let's talk to Clinton Young. Clinton, you're a former death row inmate. Tell me, what kind of effect is it when your hands are handcuffed and you are shackled when you're trying to answer something like an evaluation of your well-being?
Well, I mean, are you saying like for a psychological evaluation?
Especially for a psychological evaluation.
They had him shackled?
Yeah.
I don't know what old dude's talking about, but like the whole time I was there, I never seen anybody shackled for a psychological evaluation. I was never shackled. You have leg shackles on, but not your hand restraint. Because in order to do the proper testing, you know, you have to have your hands free. There's things that you have to do. I know people that was considered far more dangerous than Tracy. They had never had their hands shackled during a psychological evaluation. Now, TDC does give the authority to the captain, the duty captain, to make that determination. I guess for whatever reason, they chose to do that for Tracy. But every psychological evaluation I ever done, and everybody that I know that was down there with me, because you see them, there's a special room they put them in. There's an officer that sits there with a big old can of pepper spray. It tells, like, if you do anything, we're going to spray both of y'all. They have a little hole in the window so they can put pepper spray in there, right? But, yeah, I mean, it's just being behind that glass is stressful enough, especially if you've never communicated with this person before. So they're asking you to talk to a psychologist or anybody that you don't have a bond with, that you don't have any type of prior communication with, so there's no understanding. And then your first visit, that can be kind of intimidating at times, right? It doesn't matter who you're visiting, be it a lawyer, a pen pal, or whatever, right? And so if he's sitting there shackled, I mean, they're just, because the things that are required for a neurological test, you know, they give you little things like puzzles and different things you're supposed to do with your hand. You just can't do it properly with your hand shackled.
It's going to be
frustrating. It's going to aggravate them.
Yeah.
Because I know what it would do for me, right? Especially right. If you're on death row and you know that all they normally do is shackle your legs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, that's a normal thing. I guess now they're going to keep doing that.
You knew Tracy. What can you tell us about him?
I mean, over the years, it was clear, I mean, he had a really drastic mental decline. I mean, like we always say, like, oh, he's a little throwed off or things like that, right? You know, everybody generally has their own issues, but he was more coherent when I first met him than when I left. By the time I left, I mean, he's down there having arguments with himself and, you know, staring at the little silver wall, cussing people out that ain't even in there, you know, talking about officers that hadn't worked there in 10 years. I mean, it was very clear that he had a tremendous decline, right? Like, he used to go to rec all the time. He stopped going to rec. He'd tear up his property and throw it out the cell door. He tore up his radio, all his commissary, everything like that, which is a kind of a common sign for people that start to go, you know, start to go downhill, is they, for some reason or another, start tearing up and throwing away all their property.
Does life on death row make you crazy? I mean, Beatty filed a lawsuit against prison officials.
Yeah, you're in solitary confinement. I mean, I did 18 years there. I mean, there's people like T. Irvin, Harvey Irvin, Anthony Medina. There's several of them that have been there even longer. And so it's not made, I guess, it's not an environment conducive to good mental health. And so it affects all of us to different degrees in different ways. And I stayed angry. And that's one of the side effects, right, is this little things will just make me so angry that for days, I mean, for 2 or 3 days, and I finally calmed down and be like, damn, man, you know, I can't believe I was that angry over that. It really wasn't that serious, right? But it's proven that these cells have these type of psychological effects on people. and you put a human being in a situation who already has mental illness issues, and now you're putting them in there, all it's going to do is aggravate it. Then you add in the various administrations and how everything changes. One major comes in, does things this way. Another major comes in, does things that way. And there's not that the environment is not stable enough, to help our mental health in any kind of way, right? And some people, it breaks them faster than others, but it affects everybody in some kind of way. I mean, I've had a lot of honest conversations with friends of mine down there and other people that, you know, kind of poured their heart out, things that they wouldn't really just publicly speak on. Because it's kind of hard for a man, especially in a prison environment, to be open and honest about whatever struggles that you're really dealing with. Because it's kind of like, you know, it's a hyper-masculine environment. It's the penitentiary. And, you know, you take somebody like Tracy, who, like I said, I mean, he really didn't have nobody, and he already has these mental illness problems, and you throw him in that environment, and you leave him there for years, give him an execution date, take it away, put this policy, take this policy away. I mean, it's not going to be shocking that somebody goes crazy or crazier. And unfortunately, it's sad, but I've seen some good dudes, man, that really changed their life for the better while they was on death row. One in particular, I don't want to say his name to respect his privacy, but he worked out all the time. He was cool. Everybody had love and respect for him. And now he's just, I mean, it's just sad to say, but he's lost it, right? I mean, and it happens. And the longer you keep people in that environment, the worse it's going to be.
Now, of course, he said that in the Supreme Court petition, Beatty's lawyer said that one expert who examined the inmate, and this, of course, is Tracy Beatty, determined that he was clearly psychotic and has a complex paranoid delusional belief system, and that he lives, and I quote here, in a complex delusional world, end quote, where he believes there is a vast conspiracy of correctional officers who torture him via device in his ear so that he can hear their menacing voices. This is the kind.
I remember him. That's part of the reason why he would cuss out like officers that weren't even there no more.
Right.
And he would refuse to eat his food. He'd throw his commissary away because he said they were trying to do things to his commissary. I mean, that's something that becomes common there, is that they think that the officers are trying to poison their food, or other inmates are trying to poison their food. So yeah, I mean that.
Can I
pretty much been,
yeah.
comment on
Please.
Mr. Young's observations? I think what he's described is textbook paranoid schizophrenic, someone who has a paranoid delusion that people are out to get them. They're responding to hallucinations, to external stimuli, officers that aren't there. And Mr. Young's observations are absolutely correct. Confining mentally ill people in essentially solitary confinement, aside from their 1 hour of rec, is considered a form of torture. And it is absolutely going to affect, the research is clear from prisons, from POWs, from so many sources, that solitary confinement itself is degrading to the mind. In a lot of cases. And if you come in, as Mr. Young eloquently said, with a pre-existing condition, you are not going to get better. And you're particularly not going to get better in TDCJ on death row because they don't treat anyone. Occasionally, if people are bad enough and a risk to others, they will put them in Skyview. But they manage by coercion or medication, whichever combination seems to keep inmates docile.
Could you define what Skyview is?
Skyview is the psychological maximum security unit that they will send people to for extreme. And you have to be genuinely bad in a horrible condition if you're on death row to go there. And even then, their purpose is not long-term treatment. It's to get you restored to complacency.
Gentlemen, we have an interview that, of course, Houston Media Source and our producer, Elizabeth Stein, recorded recently. I think we should go, because of the length, I think we should start the interview at this point in time. Here is the final interview with Tracy Beatty.
So can you tell me your name, please?
Tracy Lane Beatty.
Very good. Nice to see you today, Tracy. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to Execution Watch.
Sure.
I'm sorry that you have a date that's coming up.
Well, they're trying to get it vacated, but, you know, way after that. They were supposed to have notified my attorney within two days of setting a date, and they didn't do it, so they're trying to get it set aside and reset now, so...
I've heard that happening before.
Yeah.
You know, which is a little absurd. You set a date, but you don't tell the person.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know I had a date. My attorney didn't know I had a date until I wrote to him and said, hey, look here, you know, why are these people telling me that I've got a date? What are you getting paid to do, you know?
Yeah, I've heard of at least one case where the same thing happened,
where
there'd been numerous stays and appeals. And the last one I knew about, they just didn't tell him.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Anyway, so tell me, do you have any idea about what you want to talk about? Because this is your time, as Robert said.
I mean, you know, like I was telling you earlier, Texas is outrageous with the way they use the death penalty, you know. Because my case has already been sent back to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals twice because they said the state proved the murder, but they didn't prove that there was any other offense during the murder, so that it shouldn't have been capital murder. They tried to say that there was a burglary committed, but they couldn't prove that there was a burglary.
So in other words, just for people who might not be familiar, in order for there to be a potential for a death penalty on a case, the state has to prove that there was it has to be a certain type of murder, or
there has to be another crime committed at the same time during the commission of the murder, and they couldn't prove that in my case, but I'm still on death row.
Right. So you're saying, and I've heard of other cases, there it should not be death penalty eligible.
No, it shouldn't be.
Yes. Okay.
Well, that's just like this guy's on death row because they were in a car with somebody who did something else, and they got convicted under what Texas uses as, they call it a law of parties. And when they actually didn't have anything to do with the commission of the crime at all, they were sitting in the car. One guy, he was sitting in the car with a guy, and he got out, they pulled up the liquor store, the guy went inside. The guy just gave him the money and told him what he wanted, you know. And he went inside, and he robbed the liquor store and shot the guy. And he comes back out with the stuff, and they, you know, acts like nothing's happened. They get stopped 20 miles down the road, you know. And they get stopped in Dallas. They killed the guy. The guy went in the liquor store at Terrell. So they get stopped in Dallas. And the guy's like, man, what in the hell? What are you all over me for? I ain't done nothing. I'm sitting in the car. I'm not even driving, man, you know. I don't know what's going on. I don't have any control of what this man goes in the store and does.
I know of cases like that.
Yeah.
And I've also heard that there are times when the person who, the trigger person, whatever you want to call them, has made a deal with police first.
Oh, yeah.
And then the person who's less responsible is the one who gets the death penalty because they didn't make the deal first.
Yeah. And, you know, that's just like, you know, they say if you participate in it, you know, it's, you know, you're just as guilty as the person that pulled the trigger.
I'm familiar with that, but when I talk to people about the Texas death penalty, I try to explain to them that, you know, you are told, the public is told, that the death penalty is reserved for the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
But of all the cases I'm familiar with, them, a lot of them could not be described that way.
Yeah, because they didn't pull the trigger.
Didn't even pull the trigger, or in many cases, it's a murder, it's a terrible murder, but it's no worse than a bunch of other that are in general population.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to distinguish, okay, now why is this person on death row and this one's in general population?
And it doesn't make sense. A lot of times it has to do with the district attorney and what kind of deal they make, too.
There's a lot of leeway among prosecutors.
Yeah. That's too much prosecutorial leeway because they get away with charging people with capital murder when they can't even prove that it was capital murder. But because the general public's not stupid, I'm not going to say stupidity, their lack of knowledge about the law.
Ignorance, yeah.
You know,
or
they're not ignorant, but you know, they just don't have, they don't have knowledge of the law.
Exactly.
And
or they've been,
the courts don't explain it to them well enough for them to make an informed decision when they're sitting up there on the jury.
Mm-hmm. Or they've gotten a lot of information from officials that maybe contains a grain of truth, but not the whole truth.
Yeah, well, that's just like in my case, the judge, Jack Skeen in Tyler, he shouldn't even have been the judge in my murder case because he had been the district attorney back in 1990 when I had a assault case mm-hmm. against the same woman mm-hmm. that I was on trial for killing.
Mm-hmm.
So he should have recused himself.
Now, you mentioned that you'd been before that DA, and I know a lot of judges come from a prosecutorial background in general, but this was a person who was on your specific case.
There's also evidence in my parole file of Jack Skeen, the judge in my trial, protesting my parole to Smith County while he was a district attorney.
Interesting.
So that man should have recused himself. He should have never been allowed to be the judge in my trial.
You know Anthony Graves?
Yeah.
When I talked to him after he was released, after being on death row for a crime he didn't commit for 12 years, I asked him, I said, how many people on death row do you think besides you are innocent? He said, well, I don't know about innocence, but there's a lot of bad cases.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that shouldn't be here because of prosecutorial misconduct.
And I guess he wound up suing the prosecutor, too.
Yeah.
I'll have to find out what's going on with that. But how did, I mean...
I think anytime it's obvious that a defense lawyer, defense lawyers too, but DAs and especially, if they're found committing misconduct, I think they should be tried themselves. And that would stop that.
I know there are people bringing cases against them.
Yeah. If they got charged with prosecutorial misconduct and they were subjected to either probation or being having their ass sent to penitentiary themselves, they wouldn't be doing that.
Right. I know of at least a couple cases where the people, once they were released and exonerated, turned their attention to the person who put them there.
Well, there's certain cases in Smith County, like the guy up there in Kaufman. I mean, he's working within the court system, and he's killing judges. Yeah. He killed a judge or prosecutors, and you know, now he's down here in prison. But he just went to an extreme in that and killed one of his own. If he would have killed somebody else, he probably would have got away with it.
Okay. Now it sounds like you're very familiar with the system. I wonder how long have you been involved in the criminal justice system?
So I first time I came to prison, I was 25 years old. Back in 1986,
mm-hmm.
and you know that was because I violated my probation.
Mm-hmm.
And after about 2 years, I was given 4 years probation, but after about two years, they just got tired of messing with me because I had violated my probation five times. for the judge.
Lots of people don't get that much.
Yeah, the judge finally said, I'm tired of messing with you. Yeah. You know, you're going to prison this time.
Yeah, some people, it only takes one time.
But then the second time, I got convicted on what I was telling you earlier about that law they got in Texas about the law of parties. I mean, I was at a friend's house, and I couldn't get my Jeep. Somebody had parked behind my Jeep, so I couldn't get out. So this guy that's there at the party, too, he said, well, come on, we'll just take my mom's car. He's driving this little Pontiac station wagon. So I get in the car with him, and we're on the way to the beer store with everybody's money for what they all wanted from the liquor store. And the cop pulls out and flashes his lights, and this guy floors the accelerator. And I'm like, man, what in the hell are you doing? Neither one of us are drunk, man, you know. We've been smoking a little marijuana, but that don't show up on a breathalyzer, man. Just pull your ass over and get the ticket, man. He said, man, I can't do that. I said, what you mean? He said, man, this ain't my car. I said, man, you said it was your mom's car. You've been driving around in the damn thing for a week. He said, man, I stole this car from Motorola Corporation. So I get convicted on the law of parties. They charge him with unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, which he had already been convicted of three times before. And they charged me with theft over $750 and less than $20,000 for the tools and testing equipment that was in the car when he stole it. I never seen it. I never seen the tools, never seen the testing equipment.
Now, how old were you then?
I was 28.
Okay. So when you first were put on probation, how old were you?
The first time I got put on probation was when I was a juvenile.
Okay.
I was like 12 years old.
12?
Yeah.
Where were you at the time?
Tyler,
okay.
Yeah, they said I had a... They didn't consider the damage that I did to the other guy sufficient for what he had done. They said that I was malicious. They put me on probation when I was 12 years old.
Okay.
Just over a fight.
Yeah.
The guy pulled a knife, and I pulled out a chain. And so he intended to cut me, so I beat the hell out of him with the chain.
Okay, so you wound up on probation. Is that, you grew up in Tyler?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was born and raised in Tyler.
Okay. And Tyler Station wants to speak with you. Have you spoken to any other?
No, I haven't spoken to any. I've never even heard of this television station that wants to see me after I see you.
Did they write you a JPay or anything?
No, they sent me an email requesting or JPay letter requesting an interview,
right.
And then I got this form to sign today.
Right. Okay.
But when I was in Tyler, I wasn't even aware of that radio station 18 years ago, or television station. I think he said it was a television station.
Yes. Yes.
Channel 19.
That's right.
I never even heard of
them. I don't know. What kind of media are you able to get here?
On death row, we get everything available on AM and FM radio.
Okay.
And over there, when you're on death watch, where I'm at now, they have guys come over there and they show movies. If you're within 2 weeks of your execution date, they ask you what kind of movies you want to see, and they bring them over there and give you a choice of which one you want to see.
Oh, when you're on death watch,
yeah.
Just 2 weeks ahead, where do they move you to a different section?
Yeah, they move everybody on death watch. When you get a date, they move you to APOD, A section. They keep everybody over there that had an execution date already set.
How was that section different?
Well, one thing, we get a 15-minute phone call every Sunday.
Okay.
To call family members and loved ones.
Now, usually a death row Do you get any phone calls?
Well, most of the time you have to request a phone call. I mean, it's like once every 90 days for 5 minutes.
Okay.
So
this is more
frequent. So once you get an execution date, they pretty well, you know, as far as the present administration, they pretty well work with you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What, now who do you wind up talking to on Sunday?
I call my daughter most of the time, or my fiance. I'm fixing to get married on the 25th.
You are?
Yeah.
Who's your fiance?
A lady named Moran Cabasso.
Where's she?
She's from Israel.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, she flew over here back when the date was set, just so she could stay with me and visit with me as much as possible before the date.
Right. Well, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
25th. How are they going to work the wedding?
They'll do it the same way we're doing here.
Okay, in the visiting area.
Yeah, she's staying with a lady over here who is an ordained minister. And she comes up here to see some of the guys on death row. And she's staying with her. They've been friends for like five and a half years.
Mm-hmm.
And she's staying with her while she's over here. So she's going to perform the ceremony.
Okay. And how did you meet your fiance?
She started writing 4 years ago.
Do you have a website?
She said she was looking on the Texas death row list of inmates for people to write, for somebody to write to, and she decided to write me. First time she wrote, I wrote her back, but evidently I put the wrong P.O. box number on or something on it, so she didn't get the letter. It came back to me about, it seemed like 4 months later before I got
Sounds
it back.
About right.
And when I got it back, I didn't have the address anymore, so then about 2 years later, she wrote again and said, hey, I wrote to you once before, but I didn't get any response.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote her back and told her, like, I responded, but evidently I did something wrong with the address or something, because you didn't get it, it came back to me.
I think people don't realize how many mix-ups can happen.
Anything can happen.
Trying to communicate with somebody in death row.
Yeah. Anything can happen. You know, the U.S. Mail's been making mistakes since they started.
Yeah, and there's so many more layers.
What they call them, the Pony Express? back when they started, you know, even they made mistakes.
Yeah. Well, then there's so many more layers for you for something to have to get through. Yeah. So you've been knowing her for a while.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she was writing us some other guys on death row too, but she quit writing them. She said she fell in love with me, and so she quit writing them. We're going to get married on the 25th.
Wow. How are you feeling about that?
I feel great.
Oh, good.
I told my daughter, I said, you're fixing to have a 29-year-old stepmother. And she said, what?
Oh, is that how old she is?
Yeah.
How old's your daughter? Oh, maybe you shouldn't answer that. But she's older than that, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Almost a decade old.
I don't want to get you in trouble, okay?
My daughter, she said, Daddy, you're 61 years old, you're still catching 29-year-old girls? I said, yeah. She said, I'm going to tell all my friends about that. She said, I'm proud of you, old man.
So it sounds like your communication with your daughter, how is she doing?
She's doing great. She's been running a aircon company down there in Austin for a while now.
Yeah.
They sent her down there to troubleshoot a bunch of stuff in the office that things weren't being done right, son. She did such a good job. They promoted her and asked her to stay down there, so she just moved all her family. And my oldest daughter's 4 kids, too. She's got a house. She got 7 kids in the house, between everywhere from 2.5 to 18. She got a house full of kids in Liberty Hill right outside of Austin. So she's doing great. My other daughter, she's... who knows where she is?
Sounds like my family. So how how the family you're in contact with, how are they, how did they react to your date? Or are they, at this point, is it a repeat of what's happened in the past?
Well, my oldest daughter, she was here. She was here with my fiance Saturday.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, they both came up here together.
How was that?
That was great. they got along. They got along great.
Good, good. Well, now, my director over here is telling me our time is up. What?
You can go as long as you want.
That's okay. Hey, I'm the producer. I don't want us to go on. You know, we don't edit these interviews or cut them. That's
okay.
Part of our deal.
Yeah.
So if I go along, we could wind up taking up the whole show. I hope we don't have one, because that'll mean your date has been vacated.
Yeah.
And I hope that's going to happen for
you. Yeah, I hope it does, too.
Yeah, we thank you so much for talking with us.
All right. And I enjoyed it.
It's just been a pleasure. And wish you good luck with your upcoming wedding.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Tell us, do you want to say anything to Texas?
Oh, yeah. Do you want to say anything to Texas and the world, actually, to our listeners abroad?
The only thing, you know, I think that what this program and other programs like it need to concentrate on and get people to talk about is the prosecutorial misconduct within the court system and the way they misuse the death penalty, because I'm not the only one on death row that shouldn't be here.
There's a lot of light we want to shine on that. On the contrast between the reality of the death penalty and the way it's promoted.
Yeah, the way it's used is, you know, they misuse it.
And we also, one of the reasons I appreciate your interviewing with us is we want to show them that despite whatever image is portrayed, that everybody we've met on death row, anybody you would meet, does not fit the image that is
portrayed. Does not fit the image of the ogre that they've been made out to be.
Like Silence of the Lambs, right? Anyway, yeah, that couldn't. So anyway, that's really the most important message of our show. It's about the people, the humanity. They're people just as varied as anyone you would meet on the street, and they're not the monsters or animals that propaganda's about.
Are you familiar with Dr. Michelle Ward and her show on cable?
No, Dr. Michelle
Ward.
No.
Yeah, she's got a cable. She's on some cable network where she interviews death row inmates.
Okay.
Her murderers, as she calls them.
But, yeah.
And she tries to portray everybody as a monster. But it completely backfired on her when she did a documentary on me.
Well, it's not reality.
Yeah, because I had 40, 50 people write me and tell me, hey, man, I know from just watching you and listening to you that you're not the monster that she tries to make you out to be.
You know, that's why we want to open up the cameras and want you to talk, because to me that's all it takes.
Yeah, because there's a lot of guys back here that I'd say at least 70-80% of the people on death row are wouldn't be here if they hadn't been under the influence of alcohol and or some other kind of drug.
Well, that's prison in general, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what I'm told.
Yeah, that's mostly the problem with recidivism in general population, too.
Well, we really appreciate your talking to us and your humanity, and wish you the best, and hope that we never have a show to do with you.
All right. Thank you. You have a good day.
Thank you, Mr. Beatty. Bye-bye.
That was the final interview recorded by Elizabeth Stein and Mark Pertle with Tracy Beatty. Let's go to our panel and those of us who are joining. Of course, we are talking with Linda Snyder in Huntsville. We're talking to Clinton Young and our panel here in Houston, Larry Douglas and Pat McCann. First, may I ask a question of Linda? Linda, is Jim Marcus any place around where you are?
Here. Can you hear us?
Yes. Is Jim Marcus there?
Yeah, this is me.
Hi, Jim. You were Tracy's attorney, is that correct?
Well, I was one member of a team.
Uh-huh.
Well, I'm here with Pat McCann and Larry Douglas. Pat, do you have any questions for Jim?
No, Jim, I just wanted to express my sympathy for where you are, and I respect the fact that you're up there with the folks on this watch very much.
Well, thank you, Pat. You never really want to get to this point, obviously, and we had a lot of appeals going, and a lot of the people think that defense lawyers win these things on technicalities, but we just basically denied review on various claims that should have been heard, but on technicalities. So it's unfortunate, but this is what it is.
Well, our hearts go out to you, to the team, and of course to Mr. Beatty for this difficult evening.
Yeah, well, thank you, Pat.
And thank you for being there, Mr. Marcos. We appreciate you being with the people on the other side, as it were.
Sure.
If you don't mind, please give us back to Linda Snyder for just a moment.
Sure, absolutely.
Linda, have we had anyone come across yet?
Yes, they've crossed the line.
Which is their way of telling us that this execution has taken place. The witnesses have come back.
It is over. Yes.
Please tell our listeners a little bit about what happens next. You have had some experience with this.
Yes, now they will go to the church, and that will be the first time that you get to actually touch him. Because all these years you're behind glass and you cannot, you don't touch the guys at all. But now tonight his wife can hug him and say goodbye to him, but he'll be already gone. It's really a sad occasion.
And we will protest your murders.
For those of you who are wondering what the noise is, that's Gloria Rubick. She, of course, is with the Texas to abolish the death penalty organization.
Yes.
And there are several other organizations out there protesting outside of the death house in Huntsville. We have heard...
We have some exchange students here also from Switzerland that are here witnessing but they're out here watching us. And they do not believe in the death penalty either.
And that's a poor, of course, part of their protest, which is a very interesting thing, and they've come a long way. And we're fascinated by the fact that people all around the world understand, apparently better than the people in Texas, what the death penalty can actually do. And
right.
Linda, have you had any chance at all to meet Tracy's wife, Marin Cabasa?
I know who she is, yes.
Okay. Well, I know this is a very difficult time for everybody. Please stay as part of this conversation and add anything that you possibly can to us. We would appreciate it.
Well, Jim told me that she was very, very upset today, so I don't know. I haven't. Well, when she came out, she got right into the lady, the chaplain from TDCJ, and they're headed over to the church right now.
Right, right. So if you don't mind, Clinton, tell me, when an execution happens on death row, how did the men react?
I mean, it depends. I mean, you have people that have, they're closer to certain people. It affects them a lot more than others. For a while, man, it's just like executions were happening so much that it there's a numbing effect.
Right.
Because it's so commonplace. But in the more recent, before death row moved to Polunsky and it was on Ellis Unit, I wasn't there, but many people said that they would do different things to show solidarity But one thing about solitary confinement is it individualizes each person, right? It breaks down the solidarity amongst the convicts. And so you start to see that as time went by, it's kind of like an ostrich with his head in the sand. Like,
right.
People just wouldn't think about it or focus on it because, who wants to focus on that really, right? It's hard. Because we're all facing death. And when you think about somebody else's execution, you got to think about your own.
Right.
But Ricky Cummings and a couple others got together and started. And Kurt, hold up. Ah.
Again, we've been talking.
Hold up a second. I'm going to show. I'll go back. All right. I'm sorry. Somebody call me real quick. But
that's all right.
Anyways,
I'm sorry to have to stop you, but I'm going to ask our panel, everyone else, do you have any final comments on this, Larry?
First, Mr. Young, if you can hear me, please understand that you have our condolences since you knew Mr. Beatty. And I hope that he's found peace. I guess my final comment is that once again, this is an example of a guy, you could actually see me in the interview reacting to what I believe was probably antipsychotic meds by that jerking back and forth. And it seems as if, while there may not be a mystery as to what happened, there is certainly no reason that that man who went through all those mental illnesses and psychotic episodes
and with that,
should have been on.
I hate to say that it's time to wrap up Execution Watch for today. Please join us on Wednesday, November the 16th, when Texas plans to usher Stephen Barbie into the death chamber in Huntsville. If it does, Execution Watch will cover the state-sanctioned killing with our live news coverage. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, we're on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. We can also get on our mailing list for all the latest updates. Thanks to our guests, Clinton Young and Pat McCann, our panel, Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie, Death House reporter Linda Snyder, executive producer and interviewer Elizabeth Stein, Elise Bench, Outreach and Development, Zara Cooney, Social Media, KPFT, and Pacifica executive producer and technical advisor Otis McClay, and Houston Media Source video director Mark Pirtle. For those listening live on KPFT 90.1 FM, stay tuned for Living Art. On behalf of the Execution Watch crew, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.